BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of my Midnight Meets podcast. Just 1 hour of weeknights on BBC Radio 5 Live. You can tune into the Colin Murray Show 10:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. Monday to Thursday. Right, this is a good one. Signed by Factory Records, then under Rough Trade before they even had a proper hit. So much happened in that time. But of course, Sit Down changed everything for the band James Come Home Too. From then, Laid broke them in America, and after one of their reunions, Whiplash was full of brilliance as well. So many stories, breakups and madness and everything in between that punctuates the band's lifespan, but all these decades later, they're still making records, and Tim Booth intensely proud of their newest, All the Colours of You, that's just been released. So without further ado, let's get on with it. This is our Midnight Meets with Tim Booth from James. Welcome to Midnight Meet.
Hello there, Colin.
I'm going to start with a quote, actually, from the Big Issue, where you said, there's something about having an illness when you're a kid that makes life amazing when you get older, in that your life actually gets better as you get healthier. Now, most people would go the other way, and you live your healthiest time when you're young, but you were undiagnosed with liver disease for most of your life, right? And until it hit ground zero?
Yeah, I mean, we think it started around 11. I just had a very yellow pallor and nobody realised I had jaundice. And my immune system was fairly shot. I was sent away to a boys' boarding school, Victorian boarding school. And they kept giving me night nurse. And in those days, it had morphine in. And because I kept getting colds all through the winter because my immune system was shot. So I lived in a fairly strange existence all through my teen years, being kind of doped up on morphine in the winter and bright yellow the rest of the time. But nobody bothered to kind of diagnose it or kind of go, maybe you should go to the doctors and see about that skin color of yours. I nearly died of it when I was 21. I stopped breathing in hospital. It got really acute about 21 and was taken to hospital and had a biopsy and stopped breathing. And remember this amazing moment where I stopped, breathed out and out and out. And it was really beautiful. But there was a nurse watching over me because apparently I was quite high risk. And she came and forced me to breathe. And I was quite resentfully took my first breaths when I was about 21 in Leeds Stepping Hill Hospital. It was awful. I mean, it had been such a miserable time. Jaundice has a really awful negative kind of whole psychology that goes with the illness. And they also, the doctor did me a big favor. He said, there's nothing in Western medicine that can treat it. And he said, in Western medicine. And so I threw myself into Eastern medicine and meditation and yoga and Chinese herbs and homeopathy and all the cranky stuff that everybody was laughing at in those days.
At the time, yeah. So what sort of saved your life in that year? What was it that made you say, okay, I'm not going to jack it in?
I'd been in James for probably 6 months as a singer and then got so sick I had to go home. It was actually really meditation was, I mean, there were tons of things that helped. And all of them have contributed to my growing health.
Yeah.
But essentially, it was meditation in the end. But it's a constant unpeeling of an onion, and not just the liver. You then kind of go, well, maybe we should get to the bottom of certain psychological things that are going on here. And you know, I'm a trained therapist, and I teach people going into trance states through dancing. So there's been a lot of other things going on in my life outside James that feed me as a human being and that feed my writing.
Where was the kind of the musical epiphany then? Did that come at boarding school?
I mean, the kids there, it was like a Victorian kind of boys' prison camp. You were called New Scum for the first year by the teachers, some of the teachers and most of the other older kids. Scum for the second year. They just abolished caning about 2 years earlier from the prefects, so you couldn't be beaten by the prefects. But it was open to abuse, the whole kind of system. So it was a horrible place to be, and music was the one kind of currency. People swapping records, playing music in the studies, that was a kind of a beacon of hope, really. You know, but I never really found it until I don't want to repeat the story. I've said it so often, but it was essentially on a night when I was told my father would probably die by my mum at 8 o'clock at night when I couldn't get home. I sneaked down at 11 o'clock at night because there's no way I was going to sleep. And I put on some headphones and I somehow managed to hear Patti Smith's Horses. Mm. And about the third track in is a song about a boy losing his father. His father died and left him alone on that New England farm. All the long black funeral cars left the scene and the boy was just standing there. It was as if someone had spread butter on all the fine points of the stars, because when he looked up, they started to slip. And it's a 9-minute improvisation about a boy losing his dad. And it shook me to the core on every level.
His father died. He left him a little farm in New England.
How could this thing reach me? How could this affect me so strongly? And I think it subconsciously put in the seed of what I wanted to do. I didn't consciously realize it until years later. And then it was like, oh, that was the moment.
It was as if someone had spread butter on all the fine points of the stars, because when he looked up, they started to slip.
I had some mad friends, we were 16, and we were allowed to go to organize a school, a trip to see some gigs. And we chose the White Riot Tour.
What, like?
First punk tour in the UK. And they didn't know what punk was, the teachers. So they went, yes, we will drive you to Wolverhampton, 30 kids dressed in school uniforms to watch The Clash, The Jam, The Subway Sec, The Buzzcocks, The Slits. And there were probably only like 600 people. And some of the other punks are dressed in school uniforms. So we didn't look terrible. We looked a little weird and out of place, but we didn't look like, you know, we got in. And then, of course, the Slits come on and the teachers strike a deal with us that we all go outside while the Slits are playing because they're not very feminine. And then they'll allow us to watch the rest of the concert because they took one look at the Slits and went, we're out of here.
But they let you watch. But the Buzzcocks were acceptable.
The Buzzcocks were acceptable, and including Orgasm Addict, which they played. And then the Clash came on. All the chairs were bolted together in rows of about five, and they were being thrown through the air, hitting the PA stacks. Bedlam. So we had a fantastic, it was revolutionary and revelatory to us 16-year-olds who just had never seen life, and here it was. You're like the second one too. Next term, right, you're allowed to organize another trip. And we go to our housemaster and he says, no way. There's no teacher in the school after what happened last time. They've all heard the story. No one will take you. And it's like, oh, you know, this isn't a punk. Well, what's his name? Iggy Pop. And he's been going at least 12 years. So he's way before punk. And they get, and the housemaster says, well, if you can persuade a teacher to take you, maybe just three of you. And we went, all the teachers, not one of them would take us. And finally, we found Roger Parks, the church organist,
yes,
who had been to boarding school to Cambridge as head of the choir to boarding school to teach. And that was his life experience. He was 6'2". He was totally willowy. And somehow me and Ralph talked him into driving us to Manchester Apollo to watch Iggy Pop fresh out of the psychiatric hospital on the Lust for Life tour. So Roger, God bless him, agreed, drove us. And we knew we had to dump him early on because the adverts were opening for him, who were a punk band.
Yeah.
And we thought he'd pull us out of the gig the minute he saw them. So we ditched him and he was in the circle and we got into the stalls. And Iggy came on shirtless, already covered in blood, with a tail between his leg, like a devil's tail. It was a horse's tail. And we ran down the aisle and a bouncer punched me in the face. And it was bedlam and it was glorious and it was Lust for Life. And Iggy was in a terrible state. They kept having to pick him up and scrape him off the floor and hang him on the microphone stand. And we had a fantastic time. And we went back to the car to meet Roger very sheepishly, realizing that we were never going to be allowed to organize another concert again. And Roger Parks was at the car, hugely excited, animated, making eye contact, going, "That was incredible.
Amazing.
What was that? It was primitive, but it was so passionate. It was so real." And he just couldn't stop talking the whole way home.
That's like so good.
He'd had an epiphany, an Iggy epiphany, as we had. And is Henry Cow any good? They're coming to Manchester next week. And it was like, I don't think that you're going to get the same experience from Henry Cow, Rod.
I think most people listening tonight know James, right? But it's almost as if James, as a committee, would sit down, pardon the pun, before every album and say, "Okay, team, how can we mess this one up?" Not every record, because you've had umpteen, but on many occasions, it seemed to be you did your best throughout your entire career to sabotage yourselves. Is that fair enough, or am I overstating it?
I think you could state it in many different ways. I think that statement of sabotage is seen from the position of that this culture values record sales hugely, and money and fame, and we didn't. And we valued art, and we made what we considered to be artistic choices. Now, some of those artistic choices may have been a little bit foolish in hindsight. We'd read too much of The Enemy, which was like almost like doctrinal, you know, the Little Red Book kind of thing in those days. And so becoming famous rock stars was a sin, you know, in the Enemy, Little Red Book, and playing stadiums was just outrageously sinful. And so we kind of avoided those things to some degree, and we followed our heart. And it meant we did some foolish things like refuse to let the Americans release Sit Down in America and things like that, which were economically obviously shoot yourself in the foot if you don't mind. But, you know, it's meant we're still a hungry band and we're still creating great music. It's kind of worked for us. Mm. We've probably made one of the best albums we've ever made that's going to come out in a few weeks' time. And how glorious is that? Mm. And I don't see that happening with many peers. I think my fear was all the bands I loved, once they got hugely successful, they stopped making great music. Mm. They got too complacent, or I don't know what happened to them, but there weren't many who maintained it. You know, Leonard Cohen maintained his songwriting ability, but he was forced by poverty because his manager stole all his money to go back on tour again at the end, which
Nick
was a
Cave.
Great,
I put Nick great, Cave in that list.
Nick Cave is the one from our generation who is, you know, clearly like just the most remarkable artist, really. But it's hard to keep sustaining moving forward as an artist without it getting too obscure. I mean, Radiohead have done it. There's an argument that they've got a little bit obscure now and again, to a point. Mind you, Nick Cave puts out those records too. And we could, if we wanted, we put out Wah Wah at the time when we were huge in the States and it blew us in the States. It's an experimental improvised album and they were expecting a follow-up to Laid, you know.
original deal was the classic Manchester deal, Tony Wilson, Factory Records. I don't know exactly what you did, but you kind of just, after one release, you were off. Did you feel like it was selling out?
We had this naive idea, obviously, that bands were judged live on how they were live. I'd seen Iggy by this point probably 15, 20 times, and it was different every night, and it was thrilling and dangerous, and you didn't know what was going to happen and who was going to get jumped on. And we've seen the Birthday Party, Nick Cave's first band. We saw them probably 8 times, James did, and they were thrilling. I mean, beyond really anything. To us, it was all about live, and we didn't want to release records. And it was only when promoters would go, well, we can't give you a gig if you don't have a record, that we were forced into recording. Mm. So Factory caught us as our most bloody-minded and naive, really. And we thought they were the Big Bad Wolf, and they weren't. We actually went off and got caught by the Big Bad Wolf, which is Sire Records. And we had a terrible time with them, and they didn't release our record for a year and a half and nearly bankrupted us. And one of the band members nearly left at that point. We were having to make ends meet by doing medical experiments, volunteering ourselves as guinea pigs to have these new drugs tested on. Wow. So we could tour and make a bit of money that kept us going in between.
Within the band, of course, at the time, you had obviously a much loved band member who had a serious drug issue. Yourself and Glennie were in Lifewave, which was a sect of sorts, wasn't it? It was where you would practice a lot of your meditation.
To some people, if they ask me about it, I'll say, well, I was a monk for 3.5 years. I was celibate, no alcohol, no drugs, meditating 16 hours every weekend, sometimes 5 days in a row, sometimes 36 hours in a row without sleep. I mean, it was boot camp, intense meditation practice. And to other people, I say it was a meditation cult, which it also was. And they're both true. And I was in a cult before then. I was in Christianity. You know, it's like we're in the time of cults right now. Mm. It's so like consensus reality, agreed reality is so disintegrated before our eyes that nobody knows what to believe anymore. And so you can see that something like QAnon or the cult of Donald Trump, it's a cult. And society is a cult. It always has been, as my 16-year-old pointed out to me about 6 months ago, in that society works because people, a certain amount of people agree to, oh, we believe money works like this and education works like this and this is what we need to know and this is what history is. And you can see in the last number of years, it has fallen apart in a big way that's exciting and scary simultaneously. But it's exciting because we're getting some truths that we didn't ever see before. I always knew, say, for example, theoretically, that money was a bit of an illusion. Mm. You know, it was a bit of like, well, what is money? And now we've seen in COVID, you know, that they just print money when they need it. And balancing the budget becomes totally irrelevant. Mm. And if they can do it now in COVID, they can do it for Extinction Crisis, because that's the next thing that needs this kind of global coming together where we all work together to save the planet. And so it's been very revealing, and very revealing in a positive way, I think. Great documentary, Adam Curtis, Can't Get You Out of My Head on BBC iPlayer at the moment. They're stunning. There's a great moment in one where Nixon takes America off the gold standard. And until that moment, you know, banks couldn't hold any more money than they held in gold. Mm. And he took them off the gold standard. And overnight, money, it just becomes an illusion. It becomes a thing that you have to believe exists and has some value, or you're really done for. And you watch the chaos overnight when Nixon took off the gold standard. It makes your jaw hit the floor.
So the third album, Rough Trade. Sat down and thought that Sit Down and Come Home, they weren't going to do the job?
When we wrote Sit Down, we knew we'd written a really big song.
Right.
And we played it live and audiences started sitting down long before it got released. Mm. And they started singing it back to us, like with the passion that we'd never seen before. We knew we had a big song and we recorded it on an album called Godmother for Rough Trade. And Jeff Travers, who has brilliant ears, and he released it down, a very amateur version. We didn't really record it that great, really. We recorded it pretty well. It's there, you know, you can hear it. And they weren't promoted really well by Rough Trade at all. Mm. And I went to see Jeff and said, you know, Jeff, you haven't promoted this. And he said, Tim, you have to understand, you as a band, James, you're never going to sell more than 20,000 records. So I can't put more money in on promotion. And I said, well, will you let us buy the album back off you? Because we will find somebody who believes we're going to sell more records than that. And he very kindly let us buy it back off him. But we did re-record Sit Down with Gil Norton, brilliant producer of the Pixies, and who'd been the first engineer on our first album, Stutter, so we knew him. And he did a much tighter version of Sit Down. And it became the hit it was, you know, and so did Come Home.
Do you still, which is a tune, by the way, do you still, are you surprised? I've got the time you'd written a big record, but did you think you'd written a single for the ages, a pop song for the ages?
We knew, you know, every so often you write a song and you look at each other and you go, oh, that's a big song. And you don't know what its time will be, but you know you've written a big song. It's accident with us. It's like we jam, we go fishing.
Right.
And sit down, we jammed in about 20 minutes and we were laughing so much we had to stop jamming because we knew something big had just come in the room. And same with Sometimes. Not with Laid. We didn't recognize Laid at all. There's certain songs. There's a song we did on the last album called Many Faces that we were fairly convinced would do something big. And I still think it probably will, but it might be more to do with racism and civil rights issues because there's various parties playing with that one. Where we wrote that song and immediately we played it live before it was released, the audience, like people cry in the front row. And leave the concert singing a song that hadn't been released. I mean, it was so strange. So you know when you've downloaded a big song.
Good producers have been so important to you because you do just jam stuff and record these huge swathes, these walls of music, and from within them you find songs. It shouldn't produce the amount of, I suppose it's you either have it or you don't. Do you know what I mean? But the way you record shouldn't really produce it. Like this album, there's so many immediate songs on it. You get there in the most bizarre of ways.
It's a magical process. You know, James weren't famous for 7 years. And for 7 years, 5 days a week, maybe 5 days a week, usually for about 5-6 hours a day, we'd get in the room and jam, just make a racket. We'd record it and we'd listen back. And if there was anything on it that we felt could be developed into a song, we'd develop it into a song. But 1 year, I remember we wrote one song from working that much, but we loved going in a room and making the racket. The racket was one of the most enjoyable parts of being in James is when we go to write. And there's three or four of us. You can't have too many or it gets too noisy and you can't hear. But there's four of us right now who do the writing and, you enter a zone and you just make magic. Nobody brings in anything. I never have any idea about what I'm going to write. It's all improvised. Then each of us can then take those improvisations and cut them up and edit them and see if you can make a vague song-sounding thing out of them. And then I start writing lyrics and then we bring a producer in. So we do the process to make these kind of fake songs, these things that sound like songs that came from us making a racket, really. And then some of them happen to sound big and very accessible and others are very small and very sweet and have a different purpose. But we write hundreds of those. Mm. Like if for an album, we will jam maybe 100 jams.
Wow.
And then choose the kind of 15 with the most potential.
you got success in the US through Laid and in so many other places as well, and that working with Brian Eno as well. It was that might of college radio, wasn't it? If they picked up on one track, all of a sudden it was everywhere and your audience was like, bang, you know, 500,000 people have bought it.
Laid was the most played single on college radio that year. Partly because of a technicality, I think, because it was 2:20. If it got to 2:30, they had to pay us more money.
Right.
It was weird because Laid's song is very different to the rest of the Laid album, which is much more meditative and kind of hypnotic. And Laid's song was an outburst of joviality amongst this kind of ethereal kind of ness. So, you know, and then we released Wah Wah, which was meant to come out with Laid because we'd recorded it in the same session with Brian. We'd go in a room and jam, and we were making Laid at the same time. And we wanted to show the two sides of James, this kind of crazy improvisational side of us and these songs, these well-crafted songs. And the record company wouldn't let us release it as a double, and they released it separately, and it destroyed us in America because all the people who brought Laid went, what the hell are this band done? What are they on?
Yeah.
That's such his life, you know.
I remember going to see you in what was one of my most favourite moments of live music, which was you were playing an event in Galway. And the girl I was with at the time, Vanessa, we were like, we cannot miss James. And we got in straight to the front and we were drunk and in love and just had the most beautiful 45 minutes. But then when I look back as a journalist, this was roughly when you were breaking up.
The music never let us down. We loved the gigs. It was the, how do I put it? I thought someone was going to die in James. The lifestyle had got a bit intense.
Right.
And so I didn't want to be party to that. I didn't want to witness that. I loved a lot of the people in James. And so I left. I didn't want to enable it either. I felt like in rock and roll, you get given everything you kind of ask for. And so you have to be very careful if you're with people who, you know, might hurt themselves with that. So I left. And I left on a high. I loved that last record, Pleased to Meet You, with Brian. We made 5 albums with Brian Eno. And every time I met bigger bands than us, like REM or Chili Peppers, they'd go, how have you got to work with Brian Eno? We've been trying to work with him for years. He just won't work with us. And it's like, he didn't work with us for the money because, you know, obviously he could have made a busload of money more with any of those bands. He worked with us because he loved what we did. And we had this mad spirit that he really, he got us. He said the most beautiful things about us. And so, you know, it was a love affair, really.
So you're right. It's funny. And again, the music doesn't let you down this time again. It's a good way of looking at it. No matter what the madness was, if you could just get in a room and jam, it worked.
I'm sorry to sound pompous, but lots of boy bands use the same terminology and, you know, bands that you might think will write crap music, they'll use the same terminology. So I may as well say it, but you feel like you're channeling something. And if your muses are still being kind to you, you know, then it's like, well, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic feeling. Mm. And that kept the band together longer probably than we should have been in the 90s.
And brought members back as well after long periods away. It's been pretty much a sliding door, hasn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah, we're very, which means that we've kept fairly decent relationships going, even when people have had to leave and come back. And, you know, there has been quite a sliding door. I mean, some of the really early members, I feel really sorry for because they didn't get to come back, but, you know, they had a hard time.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing. We've now become a 9-piece just recently on recording this record because we got this great 25-year-old girl, and we needed an extra drummer on the last album and backing vocals, female backing vocals. So we got this 25-year-old in, and I auditioned her and said, look, she was brilliant in the audition on Skype, you know, and I said, look, go up to Sheffield. The band are rehearsing Friday. I turn up Saturday and we're going on tour on Monday. And if you fit in, then, you know, you're in. But the band may go, no, it doesn't work. So yeah. I'm really sorry, but that's the best I can offer. She comes up on the Friday. I turn up on the Saturday. It was as if she'd been in the band her whole life. It was like, it was amazing. And then she came on tour with us. We had a great time. She brings her girlfriend with her, and we get on great with her. And she's a singer and drummer too. And then after a year, she says, look, Tim, I've got to go away to work with the Netflix. And it's kind of money I can't turn down. It's a reality TV show. I'll be able to get a mortgage with it. But, you know, I don't want to leave the band. Would you take my girlfriend?
Wow.
So we take Chloe, who's a brilliant singer and drummer, and we have a fantastic time with Chloe. And so then we start to rehearse about 2 weeks ago, and they both turn up.
Oh, no.
And they both like play, and then they're both like wonderful. And we're like, you know, we can't afford to have it become a nine piece. And they go, oh, you get two for the price of one. We're a nine piece right now. And we've got these two amazing women in the band whom the whole band love and get on brilliantly with.
Hmm. I like the idea of they're just tick turns. Do you know what I mean? Who wants to play drums in this track? Who wants to play drums on that track? Why not, right?
That's James in a nutshell.
Yeah. You know? You're right there. There was a period where James were so dysfunctional and outrageous. But I like the fact you recognise that, because people the whole way through this interview, I hope, are going, what, James? So I hope they're getting this sort of the story of it, which is, and it arrives here with All the Colours of You. I don't want to say it's the first time I've heard COVID-19 music, because that's not what it is. Life is about writing, you know, about experiences. All the Colours of You is about many things, but also references the quarantine. But then Recover is about losing your father-in-law. And it's, you know, it's the first piece of music I've heard that is looking back on, you know, on a horrendous period of time.
I mean, I wrote it during that time. And I would challenge the word horrendous. There were some amazing things in COVID and some appalling things in COVID.
Yeah. It's never a black and white issue.
And, you know, we got the reality of COVID very quickly when my wife's father died on the first wave, really. And we were in America, they were in England. We couldn't go see either of them. He was in a ward on his own. I mean, it was just all that awful, you know, grieving at a distance. And then a kind NHS nurse took her FaceTime into the ward so we could say goodbye to him, because he was coming off the ventilator. He chose to come off the ventilator. I think it was in Watford. That weekend, the front page of The Guardian had been that they were running out of oxygen. Hmm. And I think he was fed up. And I also think he probably was being generous, actually.
Wow.
He wasn't recovering. And so he was coming off in an hour's time off the ventilator, and they'd gone out to get him a Bellini because that was his last request.
Oh, wow.
All those NHS volunteers, all those people who volunteered. And so we got to talk to him while he was on the ventilator, and he could kind of say words, even with a ventilator down his throat. And then the nurse would step in and tell us what he was saying. And we were holding up. We had his wife on FaceTime in England, you know, and we were holding up my wife's iPhone to the computer so she could see her husband on the ventilator and talk to him and say her last words to him. And he, like, there were two amazing moments in that call, that among a few, but one was where, you know, Kate had said to him, his daughter, oh, you know, I know you're afraid, Dad. And he like wagged his finger violently at the camera, and the nurse stepped in and it was like, I'm not afraid. Oh. And he wasn't afraid. And he chose, you know, at that moment to go. And it was profound, of course, when you see a loved one who isn't afraid of death. I've seen that with my dad too. and it was really beautiful. Huh. And then he then asked me to sing him Sit Down.
Wow.
The bastard.
I was going to say, it's probably the only time. In it, like, it's the one thing you fear anyone asking. Yeah.
And, you know, I sang him Sit Down. You know what I found out yesterday? So this is fresh off the press, this one. I was with his wife yesterday, and she said he had it in his will that you would sing him Sit Down at his funeral. Oh. So I sang him Sit Down as best as I could in that given situation. Mm. And he came off the ventilator and passed within an hour.
Wow.
So we had some weird technological Alice in Wonderland completion. Mm. Well, we had what we had, and it wasn't completion. It wasn't holding a loved one as they pass, which is such a beautiful thing to experience in my experience. But it was something, and we didn't expect anything at that moment. We realized we were in the middle of a kind of war zone, and to get that was seen as a mercy, really. So yeah, I then wrote Recover maybe 4 weeks later, in quite a quick, passion.
Will he recover in a war all alone?
And then we worked with Jackknife on it, and he kind of uplifted it and made it sound like a real kind of like joyful groove song.
We've talked about this a lot on the show, Tim, in that we have this daily figure and it has been at ridiculous highs in the UK and in the States, and the overall figure runs to a phenomenal number. But the story of one is like so powerful, because I don't think I thought about one person dying from it, whether it's self-protection or whatever, to get through to some form of normality. But it made me really think about actually just that there are millions of recover stories, you know, and that's why it's made it so powerful for me.
Thank you. And that's what, well, I mean, of course we forget, you know, that's what art, one of art's functions, isn't it? And storytelling's function is to put you in the hot seat more personally, so you can actually have the empathy to feel what that might feel like. And that stretches us in all the right ways. That's what it's meant to do.
And you touched on what Jackknife Lee did to the track Recover, but in fact it's the entire album, because there's a real contradiction in the record in that it tackles so many issues that you would say are of a negative nature, which are of seismic nature, whether it be the end of the world and climate change, whether it be forest fires, a lot of these are connected, COVID-19. But there's optimism to be found all throughout this record, even on Beautiful Beaches, because it could be about beautiful love, that track. If you didn't tell me the story of it, I could find real optimism in it.
I should have kept my mouth shut what that song is about, because then all the people in lockdown would be like going, oh yes, I'm just dreaming of going to Beautiful Beaches, because it would become the escape song from COVID lockdown.
Yeah. There's loads of that, you know. All the Colours of You is an angry track, but it's also a dance track that has like it's catchy as you'd like. And even starting an album with the lyric We're All Gonna Die doesn't make me see Zero as a miserable track, as a negative track. There's a real battle going on in this record. Not even a battle, actually. It's just really comfortable bedfellows, or pessimism and optimism, it feels, in the record.
I'd have to say that that's what we've done all throughout James.
Yeah.
Sit down lyric is a pretty down lyric in some degrees. It's got some real grief in there. Come Home is appallingly, you know, after 30 years, I've become my fears. I've become the kind of man I've always hated.
Yes.
Is the main verse in that song. We've always gone for those contradictions, and the demos had them. We did have those contradictions. We aren't Joy Division, you know, where it all matches and it's really bleak. It's James have always been about, I guess that maybe it's that part that wants to be medicine, you know, and actually I'm not doing Joy Division a disservice, because that bleak can be a medicine too, for a different type of medicine. But James have always had that kind of uplift and wanting to be real simultaneously. So, you know, all those songs you referenced, you know, Zero is probably my favorite track on the album. And I worked on that track a lot. And it always had a huge uplift in it. The woes and the yays and the noes when I'm screaming. And it's about facing and accepting death, which, you know, I have quite a positive attitude towards due to my own experiences. You know, when I died and when my mother died in my arms about 7 years ago, it was a really beautiful moment. Mm. And so, you know, and of course, many people don't experience it like that. I know that. And I'm not comparing any of my own experiences to someone losing a child or anything like that, which would kill me, you know. Mm. But at the same time, I see death as a birth.
Yeah.
And you know, I do. There's these two bookends to life that nobody knows what's on the other side of the doors. Mm. And we come into this life like in the middle of a scene, you know, and oh, here's your name, here's your part, this is your mother, this is your father. And you're kind of standing there going, oh my God, is it my line? Am I, what part do I play here? Am I the hero? Am I the villain? You know, and it's a mad world, hey?
Yeah.
And this is the madness, by the way. This is where my wife goes, if you did an autobiography, they know how mad you are. Because, yeah, I've had some very extreme experiences in my life. Yeah. You know, I dance into trance states. I would dance. The longest I ever did was a month, probably 8 hours a day. Yeah. But, you know, that's a regular thing for me. And then I meditate and get to pretty altered, far-out states. And then in the last 5 years, I've been working with indigenous shamans, sometimes with plant medicine in Peru or, you know, in South America. Mm-hmm. And that's been a remarkable experience too.
Is that the ayahuasca?
Yeah, I've been in ayahuasca circles, and I've been also with the, you know, there was a documentary on BBC Two this week about using psilocybin with therapy. And yeah. I've used psilocybin with a therapist, and MDMA and ketamine and all the drugs that everyone abhorred and that was a moral panic about in the 90s and 80s. And they're medicines as well as poisons. They're both. And I never advocate anyone taking drugs in that way. Obviously, I'm a person who has to be very careful because of my liver. But if it's got strong therapeutic grid rails, it can be really life enhancing. Mm-hmm. And I know many of the therapists who are working on the trials in America at the moment, where they're going to make it legal, because it's having such strong curative reactions for PTSD and depression. And
I interviewed a 21-year-old girl who had taken all sorts of opioids and things that were 100 times stronger than heroin and couldn't get rid of her pain until she started using cannabis. She's in her early 20s, and she started about 18. She started using it and it changed her life. She was able to go to university. She was able to enjoy her life again. So the more research we do into the medical side of what these can do to help people, because we should be open to anything that can enhance people's health.
And exploration of our own consciousness. Mm. Who's allowed to tell us how and why we can't explore our own consciousness? Mm. The war against drugs was first really recorded as a religious war when the white colonizers came to South America and found all the indigenous tribes had their own sacrament, which were mushrooms or ayahuasca, and they were communicating with their gods. They murdered them and they banned them because they didn't like the competition. Mm. And they had their own sacrament, which was the blood and body of Christ, which is like a, comparatively, is like a placebo sacrament, I'm sorry to say, because it's not potent chemically, you know, it is imaginatively, and it is in terms of if you believe symbolically that's what you are receiving, of course it's going to have a powerful effect, and I don't mean to denigrate that, but these people were using poisons and medicines. I call them both. I think it's really important to keep a balance, otherwise I get too enthusiastic about, because I've seen so many life-changing things take place with people who've done this work, and in my own life. We do have to remember they can be dangerous too. I've seen people just with cannabis end up in psychiatric hospitals. I can't tell, you know, how the drug is going to work with different people. They save some people's life, and they're not so good for other people. May your mind set you free.
I'm going to push you back to your album, which is a rare situation. Well, you see the opposite.
First of all, the last album I called Living in Extraordinary Times, and that was because I just started discovering that they were going to make all these things legal. Mm. And I was like, these things are going to change people's lives. Mm. There's a great book by Michael Pollan called How to Change Your Mind. That would be the reference book if anyone wants to read about the science of this and how it works. And the songs on there, which were reflecting the experiences I was having with shamans, like What's It All About? And on this record, when we came to a song like Zero, it's like I said to Jackknife, you know, I want the whole album. I said, we want more grooves, and we want a kind of psychedelic, a contemporary psychedelic experience. And so Zero has that, and so do many of the songs on this record. They have both. And Magic Bus, you know, is harking back to the Magic Bus in the 60s. Ken Kesey, the LSD bus that went around America, you know, very irresponsibly behavior. And it's also about a cult, Magic Bus. Yeah. My interest in cults. I watch a lot of documentaries on cults, and I'm really fascinated by how everyone, you know, cults and consensus reality. I think it's really fascinating.
Let me say a couple things about the record and see if I can offend you. Would it offend you if I said that Hush actually took me to it? And see, this only can be a compliment, but it depends whether you've heard their more recent music. It put me in mind of the some of the most remarkable stuff that the Pet Shop Boys have made in more recent times. Is that on your radar?
It's not, I mean, I've not heard the Pet Shop Boys in recent years. I obviously know some of the big hits from years ago.
No, forget all that. Trust me, it's a compliment. See if this offends you. I think Isabella might be my favourite track.
Great.
It's Arcade Fire-like, it's anthemic, but it's the one track which is maybe, you can tell me lyrically what it's about. Is it as simple as it sounds, really?
No, lyrics don't always mean stuff, or they do, and I just follow my nose. Like, I had this opening line, one day soon when I die, they'll do an autopsy, find your bullet inside.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's a good opening line. The way that you killed me that night, shot a hole in my heart, some part of me died. And you're off, and you just have to keep following. And so it seems to be a story about somebody who obviously fell in love with somebody and had their heart broken, and they're freedom lovers, you know, and freedom lovers always have to risk having their hearts broken. That's the nature of being a freedom lover. You're going to at some point have your heart broken. And so it's something around that. It's interesting you say the Arcade Fire reference, because we had this bit where we did a kind of Saul did this kind of singing. And none of us knew. And we go in the studio with Jackknife, and Jackknife goes, that's a bit Arcade Fire-like. and he tried to cut it out. And the song sounded less with it. So we said, look, just put it in a couple of times around. It's too good to actually not have in. And Arcade Fire, when we met them, they were beautiful with us. And they were like, Wawa is one of our favorite albums, and we worked with Marcus Dravs because of that album.
Oh, wow. You know,
so they were very honoring of us. And we were like, great, well, if we've been influenced by Arcade Fire, it's a mutual respect, that's fine. You know, no problem with that at all.
There's so much in the record. Jackknife Lee, so often my notes went, oh, I can hear Jackknife Lee there. A grip producer, if people don't know, a grip musician as well. But does it feel like, you know, as you say, you had that great period with Brian Eno, record after record? I'm not going to compare Jackknife Lee to Brian Eno. I'm just saying, does it feel like you've found something very special in terms of the recording of this record?
I think there's three particular producers, and I'd include Charlie Andrews in there too, where you just go, you feel like you've come home, or you feel like you're meeting somebody who wants to match your enthusiasm for creating a new language or a new way of communicating, and will explore and play and, you know, and just take left turns when anyone else would go right. And, you know, it's a joy when you find that. Lee Baker, for me, has been a person who's been like that as a producer. But that's different because when I work with him, he writes nearly all music because it's been outside James, except Tamar. But it's but Jackknife was just astonishing and totally unexpected. That was the magic of COVID. You know, I don't know if we'd have worked with Jackknife if it hadn't been for COVID. It was like we were going to work with Charlie, couldn't come to England to work with Charlie Andrews, and it was like, here's a short list of producers. Oh, and Jackknife Lee, he lives 2 miles from you in Topanga. And so, well, I'll go meet him anyway. And I went and met him, and we got on like a house on fire. I'm leaving his house at 8:30 at night, pitch black. There's no streetlights in Topanga. And I'm coming down windy Swiss alpine-like hills, and two women flag me down. And I pull over and they say, there's a rattlesnake on the road and we've got our dog with us and we can't get back up the road. And I say, jump in. And I turn around and drive them back up the hill a mile. And it's Jackknife's wife and his daughter.
Oh, nice. And lucky you didn't say no. Oh, dear. Oh, that's beautiful. That is beautiful. Well, it's, as you say, the year will have thrown up beautiful moments as well as horrendous ones. And there's a great example of it, that union with Jackknife and the record that you created. We could probably do 2 or 3 hours of chatting. There was so much we didn't, but I think we definitely have captured the essence of you, Tim, in the chat, which is what it's all about. So thank you so much for all your time. I appreciate it so much.
Well, me too. I really enjoyed it. And just to reiterate, you've made it clear too, the album is incredibly uplifting, and I don't think it will end up being an old historical record, because, you know, it will be a historical record of sorts, but it's very pertinent and present, and it's the lessons we learned from COVID that will actually stay with us. That's what you try to distill.
Tell me how you stay and say.
Roller coaster ride that was. So much has gone on in the life of that band, and Tim, really grateful for his time. I love the long form chats that we have in Midnight Meets, and I can tell you, your next one coming your way is the Queen of Words, Countdown's G of the D, the amazing Susie Dent, one of the, I wouldn't say most reluctant, you know, faces on television, but certainly the shyest. She's a good friend of mine, which changes the whole dynamic of an interview when you know each other really well, as we do. But I'm really looking forward to it. Susie Dent will be our next Midnight Meets. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Tim Booth from James. And hey, thanks for subscribing. If you enjoy the podcast, if you're loving it, tell your friends.
Available now on BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Eddie Hearn, and I'm back for a third series of No Passion, No Point. In the latest episode, I'm speaking with former Manchester United and England centre-back Rio Ferdinand.
I got a phone call before, just as I was going to Leeds, and I could have gone Chelsea, and I just said to the geezers, just no point in even trying to pitch it, the idea to me. I need to leave London. I got all my mates, I go out every weekend, and I didn't have a handbrake.
And if you would have stayed in London, if you would have gone to Chelsea, who knows?
I'd have been at Orient in 2 years. Serious. Were your dad?
No passion, no point. Listen whenever you like on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.